Support for WPR comes from Hooper Corporation, an electric power and mechanical contractor dedicated to connecting people to the resources they need. A Wisconsin company since 1913. More at HooperCorp.com. Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga, offering warm clothing from Smartwool, Patagonia, and Fjallraven, including Merino Wool. Located at 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or at RutabagaShop.com.
Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at genealogy, your genealogy maybe, to begin the show. Genealogy research, it involves combining or combing through birth records, census data, and you can find a lot of fascinating information and personal history in those old records. And our guest today, they can probably tell you everything you ever needed to know about genealogy. Two guests today from the Wisconsin Historical Society. One of them, Rebecca Hopman, is the genealogy services librarian. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Great to have you here. And Jill Fuller is the reference librarian and the stacks manager at the Wisconsin Historical Society Library. And Jill, thank you for joining in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I hope you'll join in with your questions as you listen along. Do you want to know where to start researching your family history, or do you need some help finding a particular document, perhaps, that would solve a family mystery? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Well, the two of you are relatively new to leading the genealogy collection for the Wisconsin Historical Society Library and Archives. Rebecca, there's a couple of records that you've got to go through. How do you familiarize yourself, or did you familiarize yourself with the records available? What are they? 3 million maybe records?
Oh, well, more than 3 million. We've got just about 3 million pre-1907 birth, marriage, and death records at the Historical Society. Oh. So that's just a tiny portion of the whole collection. Mm-hmm. It's overwhelming how much we have. We have a pretty incredible collection at the Historical Society.
Yeah, and how'd you go about familiarizing yourself with it?
Sure. So, you know what? My favorite way of familiarizing myself with any library collection is by answering people's questions.
Yeah.
So we get all sorts of questions in the library from students and faculty, of course, many community members, many, many genealogists. And so they have really helped me these past few months. Looking at the genealogy books we have an incredible North American history collection. So we specialize in U.S. and Canadian records and history. And it's really through the patrons that I've become familiar with the collection.
Jill, I'm going to turn to you for a minute. How accessible are these records to people wanting to trace their family trees?
That's a great question. So we do have a lot of collections that are online and available on our website that people can find. We've digitized local and county history books from Wisconsin. We have maps and atlases of a variety of types that are available on our website at wisconsinhistory.org. But then there's a lot more that's not digitized and that it's just available at our library. We have newspapers that are on microfilm. We have history books for so many topics in North American and Canadian history. We have government documents that are there. We have records in our archives, naturalization papers and probate records. But we do try to make those as accessible to people as possible. So that's where your reference librarians and your archivists come in. So you can contact us and we make those as accessible to you as possible through helping you locate those records. We help guide you to what might be the best records for you for the question that you have to solve that family history mystery that you have. But also, we can help help scan those records for you and send them to you, depending on what it is you're looking for. Or we can, you know, we're there every day except Sundays. So if you want to come and look at them. And then also there's records actually at area research centers all over the state. So not just at our building in Madison, but we have archival records all over the state. So yeah, we try to make that as accessible to you as possible.
And I think it's pretty cool that your reputation, Wisconsin Historical Society records are reputed to be among the very best anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we like to say one of the top five collections in the United States. It's pretty incredible that we have such a resource in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it sure is. Andrea in Madison has a question about something that you, I think, both have mentioned in passing. Andrea, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm interested in doing the genealogy, but while I was beginning to do that process for myself, my situation is that I had a step-parent adoption when I was 7 years old. I lost my mother when I was 5, and then my father remarried, and there was a step-parent adoption later on. And it never really occurred to me about the records, but I realized when I went to get records that the step parent's name is on my official birth certificate, which I guess is normal, of course. But the point is that there's now no record of who my real mother was in the genealogical record, because my official birth certificate with the state reflects my step-parent. So my mother's name has been completely wiped out. What do you do to really...
to find more about your mother is really what you're asking, Andrea.
How do I document that my mother was really my mother?
Oh, okay.
I did contact the state that this occurred in, and I said, can't you put a stamp on the adoption certificate that says, please refer to record XYZ, which would then refer people back to my original birth certificate within the registry, of course? And they said, oh, no, that's a legislator thing. We can't do that. This is the way this is handled, and that's the way it is. Well, you know, my mother's been erased.
Yeah. Okay. Joe, let me turn to you first.
Sure. Yeah. So there's a couple of ideas on this that I have. One is with specific questions like this, we always say, go ahead and send us an email at asklibrary@wisconsinhistory.org. We can help you more in depth and give you some links and other resources that might help you. If this was in Wisconsin, there is the Wisconsin Adoption Search Program website. I'm not sure if you went through that, but that might be something that you can try, because I'm not sure exactly which record you have or if there's other existing records. But also DNA is another possibility if you do want to try to find connections to a birth family. That is something that some people do. While that's not a paper documentation, paper records, that is an option for people who have kind of hit a brick wall with other documentation for adoption. So, there is that avenue as well, if you've considered that. But if you do want to send us an email, that's we can work with you more one-on-one and kind of go over what you have done, the research you have done, the records you have tried to find, and then give you maybe some more other possibilities.
It sounds like Andrea wants to know, wants a way of somehow identifying on the certificate that her mother, her real mother, is listed.
Mm-hmm. So that is an interesting question, Andrea. It really depends state by state. I think you may have mentioned that it wasn't in Wisconsin.
Was it in Wisconsin, Andrea?
No, it was in Minnesota.
Okay. So you might want to reach out to the Minnesota Historical Society as well. They may be able to give you some guidance. It depends. With adoption, that can be a little tricky in changing the official record. So I'm not sure if you can change the record in this case, but what I would encourage you to do is to document your family tree and document your birth mother on that family tree. If you, you know, write a book about your family history, if you put your family tree up online somewhere. So that way, even though the official record may never have her name on it, depending on, again, state regulation, there will be your work out there showing that, you know, she is your mother and she, you know, has this very important place in your family tree. So even if you can't get the official record changed, it never hurts to put your own research out there and make sure your family and other people are aware of the work that you've done to document her story.
All right, Andrea, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. That was a little different kind of research, that a question there from Andrea. What are some of the more common record requests you receive from people doing genealogical research? And Rebecca, I'll start with you.
Sure. Well, I think one of the collections that is most frequently used is our vital records collection, because we do have Wisconsin birth, marriage, and death records that were created in the state before October 1st, 1907. And those are records that are mostly only available in our reading room. And so those are one of the more unique type of records that people come to us for. We also have people request Civil War muster rolls for Wisconsin ancestors who served. Or we have the special non-population census records. So if your family member was in business or owned a farm in Wisconsin in the mid to late 1800s, and there's some other schedules as well, but we have a lot of more specialized information about those kind of people that we can access.
Yeah. And Jill, I would imagine that people come to you sometimes feeling a bit overwhelmed and even hardly know where to start their searches for information about their families. What do you tell them?
Yeah, that is the case. So the first thing that we always recommend is to start with what you have at home. Start with your family records, the paperwork that you already have, the vital records maybe that you have at home. Talk to your family, get the stories from your family members, and use that as kind of the foundation for your research. And then from there, start working backwards from yourself. Sometimes we want to start with the stories that we've heard about our great-great grandparents and kind of try to prove some things, but really what works best is starting with yourself and then working backwards and filling in all of those gaps and allowing that family tree to really unfold as you go backwards in the generations. And then you're able to really follow that evidence, follow that trail backwards, and to see what comes from it. You never know what you're going to find as you go. So that's really the steps and the suggestions that we start with when someone is starting out on their genealogy.
I was thinking back to my sister at one point, sat down with a 90-year-old grandmother and 80-some-year-old aunt and recorded a long conversation with both of them about the history of the family and their weddings and the names of people and so forth. And that kind of thing is, well, it's really fun to be able to pull that out and listen to Grandma Berryman talking about having to make her own wedding dress and do all of her cooking for her wedding and so forth. But it also provides a little bit of information about what's going on in the family.
Sure. I think oral history is such an important tool. You know, when you're talking to family members, if you record their voices or even video recording, to have their presence still available, their voice, their face. But also, even though, you know, you always want to back up as much as you can family stories with data or with records.
Sure.
Those kind of wonderful stories that get lost when those people are no longer around, you know, they're so important to record while you still can. So we always encourage people as a first step, as Jill said, to sit down with your older family members or all your family members and record those personal stories.
Chris in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Chris.
Hi. So your previous caller, did she say that she wanted to know the name of her mother, or just have it recorded on the birth certificate?
I think she just wanted it recorded on the birth certificate.
So she knew the name of the woman?
Yes.
Okay, because I was going to say, if she did not, you know, if she was adopted at 5 years old, she could have gone back to the marriage record of that parent and found the name there, probably.
Yeah. And both Jill and Rebecca are nodding yes in agreement for that, which makes a lot of sense. And other people might be in that situation, so it's certainly worth mentioning. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate the call. We are talking about your family tree today on the show, and I hope you'll join in with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at genealogy on the show and your family tree with our two guests, Rebecca Hopman and Jill Fuller, both with the Wisconsin Historical Society Library. It's great to have them with us today. The weather guys will be coming along about noon to talk climate and weather with you. But right now, what about your family tree? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Eleanor in Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Sure. Hi. I just wanted to answer a question that Andrea, our previous caller, had about her birth parent.
Yes.
Something that I've gone through as well. I've gone through something similar. And you can file a petition to amend your birth certificate. So if she wanted physical documentation about her birth mother on her birth certificate, she could order a copy with her stepmother from the county she was born in and save that into her genealogy and then file a petition to update it with her birth mother's name. And she would have that paper trail.
And that's that works in Minnesota.
Yeah, I believe that does work in Minnesota. Yes.
Eleanor, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate that call. So there is Andrea. There's hope on this. You can amend your birth certificate in Minnesota. So there you go. Glad to know that. Mark in Appleton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Larry. Hey, I've got an interesting story. My grandmother was born in 1913, and when she was in her mid-60s, she found out a family secret that the woman who she thought was her sister was really her mother, and that fact was hidden for a long time. It was hidden because we, to this day, don't know who my great-grandfather was. Through a genealogical search or through some sort of a DNA test, is it possible to find out accurately who my great-grandfather may have been?
What do you think, Rebecca?
You know, I think it's very possible. DNA, certainly, if someone with his DNA were to match with you, that would certainly be a very solid clue. With the records, it really depends. You know, if his name wasn't on the birth record or he wasn't really in the family's life for that long, it might be trickier, but, you know, it's very possible that records are out there. But again, I think DNA in this case might be a good way of proving that you are technically related to him through another descendant.
Yeah. And the whole business about DNA testing, I wondered, how has interest in genealogy been affected by DNA testing?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it definitely has opened up possibilities that were not there before. You know, people who maybe were not interested in doing research or going into the records, it has allowed them to become involved in doing genealogy or finding out about their family in new ways. And also for people who maybe, like the previous caller, who could not find out things about their family or their heritage, can now maybe find some answers through DNA because maybe there wasn't anything in the paper trail. So DNA has opened some doors. And so people who have chosen to take that route have been able to find things out about their family and find new family members through doing the DNA testing.
And the testing itself is, I'm just wondering how trustworthy are the results of DNA testing when it comes to ancestry information?
Sure. Well, there are several different companies out there that you can take a DNA test through. So what I like to remind people is that the information that you're getting back from the test is only as accurate as the pool of information that company has. So, for example, if you take an ancestry test, they have a certain pool of people that have taken that test. So based on that collective result, they can give you an estimate that you're, say, 23% Swedish. But then more people will take the test, so that percentage might change to 37% Swedish. And some people might think, well, that's my DNA. How can it change? And your DNA itself isn't changing. It's the pool of data that Ancestry has to pull from. So sometimes people do take tests from multiple companies. They might take it from Ancestry and 23andMe and another one. It just really depends on what you're looking to do, and the kind of, you know, kind of information that you're looking for.
All right. So that was Mark in Appleton, I believe. Let's go to Jim in also in Appleton. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. You may have heard of the famous Brooks Brothers clothiers that are out of New York.
Yes.
I am related to that family, and the grandfather of the Brooks Brothers, Dr. David Brooks, lived in the Long Island, Oyster Bay area, and he was, as a doctor, somehow appointed or recognized by the king. So we're talking about Revolutionary War era here. Is there any records of that, maybe back in England, that I could somehow get?
That is a
Rebecca,
great...
Rebecca, yeah, go ahead, Rebecca.
So you said he was appointed by the king. Can you tell me a little more about what... Was this at a position he was appointed to?
Yes, he was recognized by the king as the doctor for that area. The king in New York City had built a hospital, and supposedly this gave him rights to access the facilities at the hospital in New York.
Okay, that's really interesting. So I might reach out to the National Archives in the UK to see if there's any, if there was like a proclamation or if it was somehow included in any kind of record there. But if that hospital still exists or, you know, has been kind of absorbed into a modern day hospital in New York that still exists, you know, I'm not sure how far their records would go back, but you could always reach out to them and see, do they have the records? Are their records held by, you know, maybe the New York Historical Society, something like that? But yeah, I would also reach out to the National Archives in the UK and see if they can help you with that.
All right. And you have the name. Obviously, you have the name of the relative of the person. And so I think that would be the biggest thing.
Yeah. And you could also, I guess you could look in newspapers at the time as well and see if there's any kind of, you know, news announcement about that. I'm not quite sure. We do have colonial papers at the Wisconsin Historical Society on microfilm, but also many of those are digitized and available on other sites as well. So you could also look in the newspapers to see what kind of coverage there would be at the time.
So as far back as the Revolutionary War?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Oh,
we do.
Jim, mm-hmm. There you go. Another opportunity for you. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Rebecca, you've had an interesting kind of history. I know for one thing, you provided genealogy for quilters back in the day.
Yes, I did. So at my last job, I was also a genealogy librarian. I worked at Ela Area Public Library in Lake Zurich, Illinois. And one of my main goals there, as well as a goal that I have while working at the Wisconsin Historical Society, is really to expand the pool of people who are interested in their family history, people who feel like they can research their family history. So, you know, even if you don't necessarily want to go back and build your 7-generation family tree on Ancestry, there are so many ways you can still tell your family story. So there's this great quilter, Deb Lindahl, in the Chicagoland area, and she has put together this quilt called 100 Dresses, 100 Memories. And each quilt square is a dress, which includes historical fabrics that have been passed down in her family from her mother and grandmother and aunts and great aunts.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
It is. And so each dress, she has written an essay about, you know, what that dress represents to her family story. And so we brought it to our quilting group at the library. And, you know, so things like that. I encourage people, if they're interested in cooking, think about the recipes that have been passed down in your family. If you're interested in crafting or technology or, you know, really anything, there's ways to incorporate your family story into all of your interests and skills.
And if you're interested in glass eyes, you even, I know on the little blurb about you, you have a story about customs agents finally catching the king of glass eye smugglers.
Yes. You know, as a librarian, Jill and I, you know, we come across all sorts of interesting stories. So Bruno Schultz was the, you know, New York newspaper declared king of glass eye smugglers. German eyes, you know, glass eye prosthetics were, you know, a little better quality than what you could get from American glass eye makers. And so he was smuggling them into the country because he could sell them for more. So he was avoiding those import taxes. And custom agents tracked him down, and I tracked him down by looking at genealogical records, by looking at census records and applications for passports and newspaper records. So, you know, even though he's not anything, he's not in my family tree, which I'm a little disappointed by. That would be a fun story. Mm-hmm. I still use those genealogy tools to find his story.
And Jill Fuller, you write and co-host a history podcast. It's kind of was interesting to me about Louise May Alcott.
I do, yes.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, so, just what you said. I have a podcast where I talk about Louise May Alcott's life and legacy. Many people just know her as the author of Little Women, but she actually wrote many Gothic thrillers, and she was a nurse in the Civil War, and she had just a really rich and full life. So I talk about her legacy and all the things that she did.
Pretty cool. What's the name of the podcast?
It is called Let Genius Burn. You can find it anywhere, Spotify, Apple Podcasts.
Yep. Let Genius Burn.
Yeah, Let Genius Burn.
Oh, I like that. And I haven't heard it yet, so I'm going to have to take a look. I'll take a listen.
There you go.
Take a listen. Mary in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Good afternoon. Good morning. This is Mary from Madison, Wisconsin. I would like to know if someone can help me find out about my mother's mother. My mother's was adopted back in about 1918, I believe, and her mother is nowhere to be found anywhere. I have been looking high and low. I do know several things about the woman. Her name was Helen Taylor Leveros. She was an actress. She lived in St. Paul, Minnesota, but I do believe that she died in Stillwater, Minnesota. What I'd like to know is, where is she buried? Who was she really? And how did she die?
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Jill, we'll start with you.
Sure. So what I love is that you have specific research questions that you're looking for. When we get requests like this from patrons, we always are asking and narrowing down what specifically are you looking for, because that's so helpful when you're doing research. So those are some great research questions. With that kind of specific research questions, I encourage you to contact us. Again, our email address at the library is asklibrary@wisconsinhistory.org. That type of research question, we can help you look for specific records and resources that we can dig up for you, send to you to try to guide you towards those answers. There are specific records like obituaries, cemetery records, funeral home records that might actually guide you towards the answers to those. So we'll ask you some more specific questions about her, about what you know, and then from there we can try to see what we can find for you.
Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And how do people get a hold of you?
So they can call us. Our phone number for the library is right on our homepage of our website, wisconsinhistory.org. They can call and it'll go right to the reference desk. There's always a reference librarian or two sitting there ready to answer the phone and answer questions. There's also that email address, asklibrary@wisconsinhistory.org. We also have one for the archives, askarchives@wisconsinhistory.org. So those are the best ways to contact us. And mm-hmm. we also, I see Rebecca's finger up. I was about to say something, but go for it, Rebecca. You could do it.
Well, this might have been what you were going to say, but you can also come and visit us in person.
Yep.
We are open to the public. You do not have to, you know, be a UW-affiliated person or have any special reason. We are free and open to the public, both the library and archives, 6 days a week, Monday mm-hmm. through Saturday. You can check our website for the specific hours, but you are welcome to come in and use any of the collections that we have. Everything is available to you. And then there are reference staff in both the library reading room and the archives reading room that can help you in person during your visit.
The other thing that I wanted to mention is that not only will we help you over email or help you if you just drop in at the desk, but Rebecca and I also do free one-on-one hour-long consultations. If you would like to sit down either in person or over Zoom and talk with us about your specific genealogy mystery that you are working on or project, you can set that up with us too. So you can, again, go on our website and email us, and we will set that up with you.
So Mary and Madison, you know, you're close. You're a couple minutes away probably from the folks if you want to do something in person as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. And thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Dee and Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dee.
Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question concerns my paternal grandfather. I found him in a census record in Indiana when he was four, and nothing else that I could find about him until he was 19 and living in Iowa.
Somehow he got to Iowa. All right. So how... What's the process here, Rebecca?
Yeah, so we would want to look at a variety of different records. It sounds like you've looked at the census. Now, it depends on what census years you're looking at. So, for example, the 1890 census has mostly been destroyed in a fire. So that is a big census year to keep in mind that we usually can't find records. But you might look in state censuses. For example, Wisconsin had a state census every 5 years for many years. So that kind of was a good in-between check-in for the federal when the federal census wasn't being taken. You could look at city directories, newspapers. There's all sorts of other ways of finding people than just the federal census. So again, like Jill has said, if you want to email us at asklibrary@wisconsinhistory.org with the specifics, we can certainly help you. But there are many other records aside from that federal census that can get us from age 4 to age 19, maybe.
Yeah, and all those are available at your place.
Yeah. And again, there are some records you can search online on our website at wisconsinhistory.org. There's also, you know, if you visit your local public library, they may have subscriptions that you can use to sites like ancestry.com and newspapers.com. We offer those to anyone that visits our library. So those are also some of the places that if you're not finding records on our site, for example, I think you mentioned Iowa and maybe Indiana. If we don't have, we will have directories and newspapers and other records from those states. But you might also visit your local library. A lot of local libraries have someone who can help you with genealogy. So you're welcome to reach out to us. But then also don't forget your local librarians can be very helpful with that.
Dee, there you go. Thank you for calling. William in Colfax, Willem in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I had a question. I'm always wondering about this because I see I had some relatives and stuff who've searched, you know, for their ancestry and things like that, and they come back and they say, you know, you're this percent Irish and that percent Dutch and that percent German, and what is the difference between the DNA of a German person and like a Norwegian person? Is there really a difference? Aren't they just all, you know, Nordic people or something?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, it involves understanding DNA, I guess.
Sure. You know, that's a really good question, and I can't say that I am an expert on the specifics of that kind of level of detail on DNA. But basically, I think, you know, these companies are able to provide locations for where, you know, certain specific kinds of DNA, you know, is commonly from. And so I think that's probably the difference. And, you know, actually over time, those companies like Ancestry, 23andMe have been able to become more specific from what I understand. You know, you might have formerly just been told that you know, had Western European DNA. And now even with certain DNA, they can tell you down to like the state or county that you're from, or, you know, again, different parts of different countries. And it's just over time how they've been able to refine it. So they've had, you know, a certain number of Norwegian people and a certain number of, or, you know, people with German heritage take the test so they can make those distinctions. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're like drastically, you know, German is drastically different from Norwegian. It's just, you know, being able to locate more precisely where your ancestors came from.
Well, it's a numbers thing. You know, if you've got millions of people, if you start with thousands and then you're up to millions, you've got the data to really be able to zero in.
Exactly.
Basically, that's it.
Right. Yeah. But if you take the test, they do, at least on Ancestry, there'll be a map and they'll show you with the percentages where on the map it matches to. But like Rebecca said, it does, you know, the more people that they have taking it, the more precisely they're able to match it. So, you know, not just German, but they'll show like, you know, kind of Baltic area or, you know, something like that. So, yeah, you'll be able to see that.
Kind of a fun story we got from Bev, who emailed to say, Bev used Ancestry.com before traveling to Newport, Ireland. Bev then met with a local tourism clerk for 2 hours in Newport. Bev was offered a book on the ancestry of Newport, dated back to 1884. Bev's great-grandfather was born in Newport and emigrated to the U.S. in 1904. Bev said she learned that her great-grandfather owned a hotel and his descendants currently owned a hair salon there. And as it happens, Bev is a hairdresser and was able to walk into their relative's business to get a haircut.
Aw, that's a great story.
That's a great, great story. I love it. Thanks, Bev, for sending that along. Bill and Ladysmith, what's on your mind?
Well, sir, I would like to know if in the case of divorce and both parents' names are left out of the birth certificate, if the child still has the ability to get his hereditary information.
Okay. Cases of divorce.
Sure. You know, in the case of a divorce, if you're looking for example, the divorce record, in Wisconsin, we do have those at the Wisconsin Historical Society. But if you're looking more for the history of the two, you know, the couple that got divorced and their ancestry, you can certainly, as long as you still have their names and maybe their dates of death or the date of marriage or divorce, you can still take those, you know, just the few pieces of information you have and look for those records from, you know, earlier in their lives. So that's something you can still certainly pursue.
Yeah. And how does Bill do that? Do you go online to your site?
Sure. So, again, if you're the divorced couple is from Wisconsin, if they were born, married, or died there, you may be able to find records in our pre-1907 vital records collection. If you want to look for the divorce record in particular, you can email askarchives@wisconsinhistory.org. But also if you email asklibrary@wisconsinhistory.org, we can help you start to access those, the records that maybe aren't searchable on our website.
Yeah. Well, on the website, I went to the website just to take a look, and you can write in names.
Mm-hmm.
And a bit of information, whatever information you have, which gives you prompts.
Yeah, yeah, we have our vital record search, our name index search. So basically, you mentioned earlier 3 million. That's the number of those birth, marriage, and death records that we have. And you can put in, I usually recommend putting in like just the last name or the first name, whatever's a little more unusual. And that will pull up all of those records that we have matching that name. So if you know, you know, if you're looking for a birth record and you know your ancestor was born in 1890 in Dane County, you can narrow down to see if that birth record is there. But you might also find that there's a newspaper clipping or a marriage record that we have in those search results as well.
I was kind of struck because the example online is Miller, which my name is Miller, M-E-I-L-L-E-R, and you were giving all different kinds of options to Miller, but Miller didn't show up in them.
Oh. Sorry about that. We'll work on that.
I chuckled to myself when I saw that. Bill, there you go. Thank you for again for calling. Susan, we'll get to you in just a minute in Minneapolis. Just a reminder, our guests today, Rebecca Hopman and Jill Fuller, from the Genealogy Services at the Wisconsin Historical Society Library. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at genealogy on the program today, great to have our two guests, Rebecca Hopman and Jill Fuller from the Wisconsin Historical Society Library. Just a quick mention, tomorrow on the show we'll talk about dog trading with Patricia McConnell, and then we'll look at cat care with Angie Ruppel. So that's tomorrow. But right now, it's your family history, and Susan in Minneapolis, Minnesota has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Actually, I have three questions about the DNA mail-in services. The first one is, I've heard that 23andMe is in financial trouble, and I have a box kit sitting on my desk from them as well as from Ancestry. Should I rush getting that in because they might go out of business?
Well, who knows?
Yeah, that I wouldn't be able to speak to that. I'm not sure on the future of 23andMe, but I mean, certainly if you already have the kit and you want to go ahead and do it, then I wouldn't hesitate.
Yeah.
Okay, and then my second question is, I know somebody who is curious about his heritage. He's adopted, but most of the popular kits say that they also give you information about your odds of certain medical conditions, and his position is he does not want to know if they're going to tell him that he has a predisposition toward something
bad,
fatal, or horrific.
Yeah.
Which one should he go to that won't tell him anything awful medically?
So 23andMe is from what my understanding, that one tends to be more geared towards medical health and history. So he may want to look into the ancestry test. Again, any DNA test, there is always risks as well as benefits. So I just, with, you know, Rebecca and I can't suggest or recommend any DNA tests. That's really not what we do at the library. But what we could say is that, you know, it's always worth doing your research and looking into anything before you do any sort of DNA testing.
Yeah.
Okay. And then,
sorry, go ahead, Susan.
I'm sorry about that. I read that when DNA from families is used to solve cold cases, they aren't pulling DNA from 23andMe or Ancestry, and I'm wondering what companies they do get DNA from, and then thinking, in a way, are we kind of limiting the opportunities for people we're genetically related to get away with a crime if we put our DNA out there?
We, I have no idea who the authorities use, and I don't think Jill or Rebecca know either.
I think, I think the practices around this have been evolving very rapidly over the last few years. It's a fairly new method for, investigators to use. So I couldn't speak to the specifics, but it is, again, like Jill said, it's one of the considerations when you take a DNA test. you know, I think some of the companies have come out pretty strongly to say that they will not share their data. Again, you'd want to do research into the individual companies. But it is something to consider that you are putting this information out on the internet with, you know, with different companies. And so to just really think about the consequences, whether it's finding out that medical information that you may or may not want to know, you know, maybe uncovering a family secret. There's a lot of really amazing things that DNA can do, but you also want to be careful and think through your options when you're considering whether or not to take a DNA test.
Mm-hmm. Susan, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Brad in Madison emailed to say they've heard that the Mormons are experts in genealogy. Are their records readily available to the public? And I believe they indeed are.
Yes, I'm so glad that this came up. So FamilySearch.org is another one of those major genealogy websites that you can look for a lot of the same records you'll find on Ancestry and Fold3 and some of these other databases. And that is something you can sign up for free for an account. And libraries like ours, like the Wisconsin Historical Society Library, are often what you call affiliate libraries. So you can see a certain number of records from home. And then there are more records you can see when you're using our computers in our building. So it's another reason why you may want to come in to our library, you know, to your local public library. You can check to see, but they give you access to an additional like layer of records. But that's another great website to start your genealogy research on.
Yeah, absolutely. And wanted to turn for a minute at least to the new History Center. The Wisconsin Historical Society plans to build a new Wisconsin History Center on the Capitol Square in Madison. It looks fantastic. Tell us a little about it. Jill, do you want to start?
Sure. Yeah. So in a few years' time, we're going to have a brand new History Center that's going to be on the square in the same location as the one that we've had there before, but it's going to have a larger footprint. It's actually going to be expanded. And so this new History Center, it's going to double the exhibition space. It's going to have they're going to be breaking ground actually really soon. So this is just, it's really exciting, something to everyone should keep their eye on. And we did provide a link. We've got a video of what it's going to look like inside so people can get an idea of what those gallery spaces will look like. And it's going to be telling the Wisconsin story in a new and engaging way. So we encourage everyone to keep their eyes and ears open for news about that new History Center. We're all very excited about it. And in the meantime, we have a makerspace that's still open that people can come and do events. And we have, you know, our historic sites around the state. So there's still many ways that people can engage with the Wisconsin Historical Society, not just our library and archives, but our sites as well. Well,
that video of the what's there, I mean, the new building is absolutely fantastic. I told Joel Patton, our producer, to put the link up on our page for today's show. So
great.
WPR.org/Larry, go to today's date, and within the notes section, you'll get a link to the video, and I was just really pleasantly surprised to see everything that's going into it.
Yeah.
And it's going to really be state of the art.
Everyone's putting in a lot of work, but it's going to be well worth the wait.
Yeah. What's the most common question you get when you is sitting by next to the phone or somebody comes in, Rebecca?
Really, the most common question is, how do I get started? You know, maybe they mm-hmm. say, I'm interested in learning about my great-grandfather, or I'm interested in, you know, learning about my family, but how do I get started is really the most common question. And, you know, it's really about, like Jill said earlier, collecting the information you already have, talking to relatives, and then when you're ready, you know, doing a search on our website, getting started with some of those basic genealogical records, and building that family tree.
Yeah. Do you ever keep track of how many calls and requests for information you get over the course of a year?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How many do you get, Jill?
Oh, I don't know if we have the number in front of us. Actually, we do keep track, though. I don't have those numbers in front. It's hundreds and hundreds. I mean, we get lots of calls, lots of visits, lots of emails. We're busy every day.
I was actually just looking at the numbers this
morning.
Oh,
were you? Okay, Rebecca's
good.
Got it.
Well,
she's prepared.
All right, Rebecca, tell us.
Well, it was just fortunate. I'm doing some reporting for the year to kind of make plans for the new year, and we have several different systems that we count these numbers in, so it's hard to get a one grand number. But I will say, just for people that call us or come in person, over the last few years, in the library specifically, we average at least 500 to 550 genealogy questions a year. And that's when it's like the main thing is genealogy, like the first thing. There's lots of thousands of questions we get every year that have genealogy built in. And then our email system, too, I would say at least in the hundreds of questions every single year. So lots and lots and lots.
Yeah. And so it gets into the thousands when you add it all up. Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a lot of fun talking with you both today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for
having
us.
And we'll do it again.
Sounds great.
How's that sound?
Perfect.
Right.
We love it.
Rebecca Hoffman is the Genealogy Services Librarian at the Wisconsin Historical Society Library. Jill Fuller is a Reference Librarian and the Stacks Manager at the Wisconsin Historical Society Library. They've been on the job a short time, but they obviously know a whole lot about what the heck they're doing. And we'll have them back and do it again. Coming up, the Weather Guys will be with us. I'm Larry Mueller. You know, last week, Wisconsin saw its first snowfall of the season, and I'm sure it's a sign of more to come. Down the road, Larry Mueller here. The Weather Guys are back. That voice you might have heard just now, John Martin, with me in the studio, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Good to be here.
And with us by phone today, Steve Ackerman, former vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW-Madison, also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back to you.
It's great to be back. I am one of those people who is traveling that you just reported on.
Well, I want to talk to you in just a minute, but I want to remind our listeners here, if you have a question, weather, climate question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. And, Steve, I want to go to you first. You're out west, and I was thinking about atmospheric rivers this morning, and I looked online, and sure enough, right now, the state of California is getting hit by an atmospheric river. Can you tell us anything about it? Is it hitting any areas where you are?
I'm going to let John get into the atmospheric river part and the storms that are occurring, because he just gave a really great talk on Friday about that. But, the atmospheric rivers are associated with the jet stream. The West Coast, up and down the West Coast, California, is getting precipitation. San Francisco flooded yesterday, I think it was, pretty bad. Where I am, we're in the southeast corner of the state of Washington, and we got a lot of fog here this morning, but we haven't had any precipitation yet.
Well, let's, John, let me turn to you then.
Yeah.
Explain what's going on with this atmospheric river.
Yeah, I'll have to say right off the top that I'm not a fan of that term. I think the term has become overused, and the media jumps all over it as if it were a brand new discovery. And the fact is that it's a really good concept to say that a substantial amount of water vapor flows from the tropics to the extratropics in narrow corridors in the atmosphere. And that's interesting and very important to understand. But every time one of these so-called atmospheric rivers dumps a lot of rain on the West Coast states, particularly California, it's a function of the development of weather systems that engender and encourage that northward transport of water vapor. So they're really not a new thing. They're kind of a new discovery that a lot of the water vapor comes in a narrow little highway, transport highway. But they're tied to extratropical cyclones, which we understand pretty well and can make now, in this modern era, reasonable predictions of. So people don't get surprised by these things. However, the amounts of rain are extraordinary because this is a tropical moisture plume that gets thrown up against the high terrain of the Sierra. And if you're below freezing, it's liquid water. And if you're above freezing, it's snow. And places in Northern California late last week had, or actually over the weekend as well, had over 100 inches of snow widespread. And that's about a seventh of their entire season. It can come in one event. So these things are really impactful for the water budget of the state of California, which matters to all of us because, you know, if you eat fruits and vegetables, you're eating stuff from California.
and it never makes it to Wisconsin, that river that we're talking about.
That's correct, because that's going to be wrung out as it goes over the Rocky Mountains. And the first encounter is the Sierra Madre. Sierra Nevada, and then it can't get all the way across the high terrain. It gets wrung out.
Well, here's a question that I don't know if I can even pronounce it all. Stephanie from Thiensville emailed to ask you to speak about the Beaufort-Geyer release and its connection to Atlantic Meridional overturning circulation.
Oh, yeah, the Beaufort Gyre, I think, is probably
is that what
it
is. Is that what it is? Beaufort Gyre?
Yeah, it's one of the oceanic circulation features that is kind of a standing feature in I think, the North Atlantic. And so we talk about this so-called Atlantic Meridional overturning circulation. Meridional is an adjective that means north-south.
Okay.
And Atlantic is geographic. So it's a north-south overturning circulation of water in the Atlantic Basin. And it's controlled by lots of interesting small components that work in concert to drive it rather substantially and keep the Gulf Stream pumping poleward on the east coast of North America. One of the factors is cold air that funnels off of the Canadian archipelago and the high latitudes of the north through the mouth of the Labrador Sea. That really not only cools the water at the mouth of the Labrador Sea, which is south of Greenland, but also creates enormous amounts of evaporation, which makes the water fresher and less dense. And so you have these competing effects of trying to pump cold, dense water downward at the mouth of the Labrador Sea that kind of primes the whole circulation and then sends tropical warm water poleward. If the one of the pieces of the puzzle in this Atlantic Meridional overturning circulation were to suddenly stop contributing for one reason or another, you would have potentially very rapid shifts in the way that warm water is pumped poleward in the North Atlantic. And that could change a lot about the regional climates of eastern North America and western Europe. And so there's some threat that could happen.
And so some sea level rise could occur?
Maybe the opposite. Maybe there'd be more ice, and so the water would freeze up a little bit and not raise the sea level, but make it a lot colder in places like Iceland and London and Sweden and Norway you know, northern France and Spain than it is right now. So that's a possibility.
Kurt in Chippewa Falls has a question for us. Let's go there. Yeah. Hi, Kurt.
Okay, thanks. I'm wondering if we in this country, at least 20, 30 years ago, had seriously the financial costs incurred through climate change, global warming. Is there a way of calculating the money that would have been saved, or put another way, the money that we have lost on treating storm events and so on and so forth over the last several decades? Is there a way of calculating a number for that?
Hmm. Steve, what do you think?
I'm not an economist, but I know that there have been estimates with what is the cost to individuals and to nations due to climate change that has occurred in the last 20, 30 years, and also out into the future. The challenge to do that is to be able to look at a weather event, you know, from the weather perspective, you know, like the flooding we had in North Carolina, and then be able to attribute that to the climate change that has occurred, and then look at that cost to ameliorate what those effects were, and to is also in the other area, but then also to try and look at, okay, what those costs were in relation to if we, what were the costs back to 20, 30 years ago if we try to cut back on carbon dioxide emissions. So there is a way, and I know that there are economists that look at that, but I don't know what those costs specifically are.
Yeah, I don't either. And I think I've talked to some people who deal with forecasts and reinsurance and the primary insurance industry, and they would definitely agree, Steve, that whether you count the number of events or the cost of those events or some mix of the two, they would be able to tell you at the end of the day that 20 or 30 years ago, insurance companies could stay in business at a certain rate premium that they cannot stay in business anymore when it has to do with weather-related insurance. And there's no way that those people are being confused. You know, you talk to insurance and reinsurance agents, they know the climate's changing and it's impacting their business. It's impacting the viability of their business, in fact, and in a very serious way. So I would guess that they would be really good people to talk to get an answer to this question. And it strikes me that, you know, it brings up the old story of the big difference between spending and investment. You know, willy-nilly spending is maybe something we want to try to avoid as a nation, but investment is not something we want to try to avoid as a nation. And I think, you know, if you're investing in trying to recoup losses in the 30 or 50 year time frame, unfortunately we're behind where we would be, but this doesn't mean we shouldn't start now.
Yeah.
On a personal level, you know, when Madison got flooded back in 2011, I think it was.
I
ended up taking out flood insurance because we live near the water, one of the water bodies. And this past year, you know, it almost doubled, the flood insurance for our house, you know, to the point where I was trying to ascertain whether or not it was worth it. We ended up getting it. But again, it's that balance of, okay, it's gone up, it's doubled. Now what do I do about that?
Yeah. You know, and I heard this from a couple of people in that industry, and they say, you know, it's not just the cost of insuring, it's the cost of replacement that makes a lot of their book cost more to replace than it does to insure. And that's when they go under. They can't do that. And, buying plywood and buying all the rest of the lumber and building supplies is too expensive to make up for the losses that people are experiencing. And this is a very serious problem. It's looming. I'm sure people in North Carolina have already dealt with it. And we're going to all hear about it more, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Thanks for that comment. Let's go to Mike in Madison next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. So my question is, we typically the Earth goes through glacial periods about every, I think, 40,000 years, and we were due to go into another one. Do we know from ice cores or other geological data how quickly that transition might have occurred if there hadn't been global warming? Would it have been like a light switch, and 1 year we had spring, summer, and fall, and then the next year we had perpetual winter? Or is it more like a dimmer where over centuries it would have transitioned?
Oh.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you put it in nice terms. I think it's definitely the second. It's over centuries. We can look back through those ice cores. And the cool thing about the ice cores is, you know, anybody who's gone skating on the lakes here in town or anywhere in this part of the country realizes that if you go out and put your skates on, you're going to find little bubbles of air in the ice. Sometimes they're so big you got to avoid those spots. But those bubbles of air have exactly the same composition chemically as the air that you're breathing as you skate across the lake. And so this is what we do with these ice cores. We find bubbles in the ice that are 800,000 or a million years old, and you can bring that air that's in the bubbles into the laboratory with sophisticated equipment and count what the molecular makeup is of that air. And you can thereby measure the carbon dioxide fraction. Mm-hmm. And it goes up and down over that long geological time. At least in the last million or so years, it's gone from highs of around 300 molecules per million to lows of about 180. And those swings up and down are naturally occurring, but they're spread out over between 75 and 100,000 years. They take a long time to come about. So the dramatic increase that we've seen in the carbon dioxide fraction in our atmosphere now that's occurred since about 1850, it's gone up to 422 parts per million, well above the last million-year long-term average. And it's increased by, 200 or so percent in that 150-ish years. And so this is not related to some natural variability, and we're seeing this is like a light switch, but the background variability is not definitely not like a light switch.
Mike, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW, our guests today. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Steve Ackerman and John Martin. And as a reminder, if you miss a part of our show, you want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of all of our broadcasts. So just a little point of information right now. If you have a climate and weather question, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Mary Kay in Kenosha has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I have a question. Weather patterns and climate change, aren't they the same thing? And if a weather pattern is a weather pattern, we really can't do nothing about a weather pattern, can we?
Well, that's an excellent question. Steve, you want to go after that?
I'll start and then turn it over to you. But I agree, it's an excellent question because they are interlinked. So when we think of climate, we think of it as the collective state of the atmosphere for a given place over a specified interval of time. And that's why you'll hear us, our phrases like the urban climate, so we're talking about the climate of a city, or global climate, which is where we're talking about, obviously, the globe climate. When we talk about climate change, we're looking at the long-term change in average weather patterns as well as changes in the climate, because, as Mary Kay's pointing out, they are tied together. How the patterns, the idea of the weather patterns is to move energy around in the atmosphere in order to try and balance off the increased amount of energy we're getting in the tropics from the sun versus the energy we're losing at the polar regions. So the weather patterns and the ocean patterns are trying to move that energy around. And so the climate and the weather patterns are very much linked together. Very hard to do anything about weather patterns. In fact, I would say we cannot do things about weather patterns. We do change the climate, and I think generally unintentionally. I think when we started building the cities, we weren't thinking about how that's going to affect that local climate. And the same thing now with carbon dioxide emissions, although now we know that they are changing the climate. And the question is, what can we do about that?
Yeah. John, to add to that?
Yeah, it's a good description. I think the way I like to think about this is that the climate sets the background rules for the way the weather will evolve. And so, you know, the nature of the climate is, you know, let's talk about particularly the carbon dioxide fraction as one element of the background rules. When that's gone up, that's created an environment that allows for a set of possibilities today that didn't exist as much 100 or 200 years ago. And the average weather of today, therefore, reflects that range of new possibilities. And, you know, and therefore, when you look at the average weather as a means to describe the climate, it makes perfect sense because the climate is setting the rules in which those weather patterns can develop. So I think about it this way. When we come to the main part of your question about can we do anything about climate or the weather? You know, I love baseball, and right now the bases are 90 feet apart. If by some fiat, some rule, they were changed to be 80 feet apart, you'd suddenly see people having a higher batting average. Everything about the complexion of the game would change because something about the background rules was changed. And you might sit there as a baseball fan and wonder, how come people are getting 400 hits a season now? What's going on? And you might then go back and say, why did we make this change to the rules? That's changed everything about the game. And we could, therefore, remake changes to the rules, and then we have to let the game play out. So if we change the chemical composition of the atmosphere, that's like changing the background rules of the climate system. And then we let the weather play out in that new climate system. If we don't like the weather, we got to do something about the background rules somehow. So that's what I think.
Yeah, very, very good way of describing it from both of you.
Yeah,
yeah, from both of you. Thanks for that question. Paul in Elkhorn has an idea. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Larry, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I have a question for your guests. I've been interested and lived through many hurricanes in my life, and I was just curious about this concept brainstorm I had. If we got all of the military aircraft that transports and put shaved dry ice into these aircraft and dropped it all on the center of a hurricane, would that be possible to?
Ooh, we suddenly lost our phones. So, and in fact, all of our phones went off. So I don't know what happened there, but I think you get the idea.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah. The notion of it's called weather modification. Is it possible to do weather modification on a scale the size of a tropical cyclone, a vigorous hurricane? This was something that was first considered seriously in the 1940s and 50s in weird ways, actually. We came out of World War II and we had just, discovered we'd gotten atomic energy under some sort of, control. We had computers, we had radar, all sorts of other things. And we thought maybe if we could predict the weather, if we could put atomic bombs in the right place, we could discourage the attack of weather systems on one place or another. We were kind of filled with hubris after World War II. And in a similar way, I think trying to mount an effort on the scale of even the small scale tropical cyclones is just impossible when you come right down to the nuts and bolts. These things cover hundreds of millions of square kilometers. They are made up of enormous amounts of water vapor and then small little meteorological or hydrological particles, ice and water. And to try and combat them with some sort of a scheme whereby you seed the clouds is not possible. And I think people in the field are ready to say that broadly.
So, Paul, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Greg is in the car driving and called but couldn't stay with us. They read a recent study about groundwater pumping that is changing the rotation of the earth, wondering how this could affect the weather.
I don't know how that works, but one of the factors for weather in the middle latitudes is the rotation rate of the earth. But you'd have to change it by an awful lot to have any discernible impact on the way weather systems get themselves organized. The earth's rotation undergoes natural variability of a little bit. I don't know what Steve knows, maybe. Is he still on the air? We have Steve?
Steve, did we? Oh, good. We didn't lose you. Okay.
No, it didn't lose me yet. And, yeah, it does wobble, and that is on a longer time scale that often aligns with climate regimes. But, if you're pumping water out, I can see it causing problems because we've seen pictures in Arizona, I think it is, where you really see the land drop as they've been pumping water out for decades. But I don't see how those kinds of impacts would really affect weather. Again, the scale's just too large.
Right.
Too much
right.
energy.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
So I've got a question relating to the Commerce Department. The National Weather Service is an office of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, but NOAA is administered by the U.S. Department of Commerce. And I guess there's some reasons for that, John.
Yeah, they've grown in profile, in my opinion, too, because, the weather and the climate, especially the weather, has a big influence on commerce broadly. And I think this has become more and more recognized over the last several decades, if it wasn't before. The Weather Bureau started out as part of the Telegraph Office, which was in the Department of the War Department in the 1870s and 80s. And it quickly became clear that there's a commerce side to keeping track of the weather. So that didn't take long for that to happen. Yeah, so Department of Commerce is a huge, sprawling agency of the government, and it does contain NOAA, and the National Weather Service is contained within NOAA. And NOAA means National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So we're keeping track of both the atmosphere and the ocean. And you can see the commercial the important commercial things that go on both in the atmosphere and the ocean. So it's a major part of the Commerce Department's purview. is to make sure we do a good job monitoring the oceans and the atmosphere for our citizens. And, you know, maybe there's a bit of a push now. We got a nominee who is, you know, from Cantor Fitzgerald. I think he's one of these people who sees the government as just an extension of business. The big difference there to me is that a government agency has a civic responsibility to the citizens of the country. A for-profit agency has a responsibility to shareholders. They're not the same thing, and they're fundamentally different. And we really got to be careful that we don't confuse government and civic responsibilities with responsibilities to satisfy shareholders.
I saw the Project 2025, that presidential policy agenda, which was, I think, drafted by the Heritage Foundation, suggested NOAA be downsized and maybe privatized somehow.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that, Steve?
Yeah, first, I'm going to give you my thoughts, but I think John really made a really good point there. There's real difference between the fundamental difference between a government agency and what it provides and what a private agency does. And with regard to NOAA and National Weather Service, they're very much integrated. But with regard to 2025 and separating NOAA and the National Weather Service and downsizing it, you know, there's no doubt we're about to go through some change as a country. And when we go through big times of big changes, whether it's political or social, I think it's really important that we have a sense of what grounds us. You know, what are our core values, both as individuals and communities? You know, what do we guide our decisions on? What's most important to us? What are the qualities that we strive to embody? And for me, those values include openness, honesty, fairness, objectivity, accountability. And I think that these are things that align with the scientific community in general. So when we read sections about Project 25 and see them smear NOAA as one of the drivers of climate change in an alarmist kind of way, it just does not align with my core values of honesty and objectivity.
Right.
The National Weather Service and NOAA are communities that save lives.
Yeah.
They collect data, they distribute it in honest and objective ways. And the forecasts that they make are not from a political point of view. They are not ideological. They are based on data and facts, and they save lives. They help people, their homes, and their families. It's real. And so to downsize that, to split it up, to commercialize it would be a future disaster for the United States.
I completely agree. And, you know, one of the main things that hits me, that was an excellent discussion, Steve. One of the main things that hits me is the whole notion that they tried this in the late 90s. John Boehner and a few other people wanted to privatize the Weather Service. This was, and Kasich was another one. And the idea that a private company, a for-profit company, would be as responsible in doing its forecast verification and thereby renovating their processes so they make a better forecast next time is complete nonsense. They would never do it. There'd be no pressure on them for, in a for-profit environment to make a better forecast, because if they're the only ones making it, they can hype the ones that are right and they can just forget about the ones that are wrong. The National Weather Service cannot do that. It has an obligation to get better and better and better, and also to be honest, as you pointed out, with the public about when it has failings, and they are increasingly rare. And so it's an absolute disaster waiting to happen, and I wish we could get the ear of some of these people at least to get them to think about this in a way that's a little bit less scary.
And I want to add, this does not mean that John and I are against commercial weather companies.
Correct.
They are extremely valuable because they do local forecasts or local forecasts for particular industries. The thing is, they use the public data that are provided by NOAA or NASA in order to serve their customers. So they're important, but you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah. What company is going to supply for free that information to competitive companies? They're not going to do it.
And to the public.
Yeah, and to the public.
I mean, a lot of the data that we look at is freely available. Yeah. We're not paying for it.
They're not going to do it. And that's going to be a real logjam of information, which will have dire consequences, as you pointed out.
Yeah. On that note, we'll take another call. Tom in Oconto has something relating to climate, I believe, with a name change, perhaps, Tom?
Well, I have a suggestion. Since there's all this conflict and everything, why don't we refer to what is happening as climate evolution, which is basically what it's doing, rather than climate change. Maybe that'll change the attitude of some people.
The only thing that I would point against that is evolution to me means natural kind of activities, whereas what's happening right now are, it's not evolving. It's due to a change that we are forcing.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think that, you know, the more we try to make this, more palatable for those who are just, you know, at this day and age, still skeptical of whether or not there's a problem. I'm tired of trying to satisfy the skeptics that there's a problem. I want to join with them and try and solve it and figure out some good ways for an industrial country like our own that has a desire to continue to make progress, to do it in a way that we can sustain. But to suggest that, you know, there's something broadly natural going on here in the last 150 years is, as Steve says, completely false. And so anything that gives that impression is detracting from solving this problem.
Jim in the town of Middleton emailed to ask you to discuss a mostly discredited report that there is a limit to how much greenhouse gases can be absorbed by the atmosphere and that it has already reached a point that no more CO2 can be absorbed.
I have not heard about that. I thought we don't know how much more can be absorbed by the ocean. We're not sure about that. But a lot of the water in the ocean is out of play. It stays at depth for thousands of years, and it won't come back to the surface for any reason until then. And so that might be the least saturated with carbon dioxide water in the ocean, but it's not going to come to the surface to be able to absorb more of it for, you know, a long, long period of time. I don't know the answer to that because it's not exactly my specialty about how close we are to saturation in the atmosphere, but I suspect we got a long way to go. I don't think we're talking about 400 molecules per million. I'm sure there's room for 50 or 100 more and probably 1,000 more per million because that's not a lot of space. So. Yeah.
Anne emailed to say they're interested in a large number of days that have poor air quality in Madison. The Weather Channel posts hourly figures along with the labels of good and moderate. Anne wants to know why we are having so many moderate to poor days as an asthma sufferer. Anne says this is a major health issue for them.
Yeah, it sure is.
It's definitely a health issue. And I think the reason recently has been associated with fires that have been going on in Canada as well as on the West Coast, and some of that in the Midwest as well, and then that being transported over our area.
Yeah, and then as it gets colder, as the cold season looms as it is now, then you can have low-level, what they're called, is temperature inversions overnight.
Yeah.
And so the temperature actually increases away from the ground for some distance, and it's really hard to mix that air. It's resistant to mixing in the vertical. And as a consequence, anything that's poured out into that so-called boundary layer of air, the one that's right at the boundary of the surface, stays in it for a long time, especially in the mornings into the early afternoon on days that are otherwise quiescent. And so you have some problems with local chemical composition changes because of pollution, just regular everyday pollution, not the kind that's changing the background climate.
Hmm. Our guests today, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, are weather guys from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Questions for them? Join in. We'll get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking weather and climate with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. An email about meteorological bombs. And you guys, I think, had some information on this in a recent column that you wrote. What is it? And maybe explain that phenomena.
Yeah, it's a term of art that kind of came about in the early 1980s. A couple of colleagues of mine had studied really rapidly developing, rapidly intensifying cyclones in the middle latitudes, the kind that affect us here in Madison, especially in the wintertime. And they came up with a threshold that if a cyclone's central pressure dropped by more than 2% of its average value in less than a day, that was an explosively deepening cyclone. And the word explosively deepening kind of started to catch on. People would say, oh, it's like a bomb. Yeah, it's like a bomb. So that's the word that's kind of in the press now, is the bomb side of that. And the one that just happened off the coast of California last week lost 6% of the average sea level pressure in less than a day. So it was three or four times stronger than the ones that struggle to qualify as bomb cyclones. This thing was extraordinary. And we saw one rather like it about 5 years ago. A graduate student of mine and I are working on that one right now. But this will be one that we have to work on. I'll probably ride this one to retirement, trying to understand this one. But it's a phenomenon that occurs especially in the cold season, and it's always interesting. Tropical storms can undergo the same kind of explosive or very rapid intensification. But they're somehow, to me, they're more interesting in the extratropics because they don't have a hurricane helping them do it. You know, it's a little bit hotter job to do, but they are extraordinary.
They are.
So, John, I have a question for you. Because associated with this bomb that just recently occurred, I started seeing the phrase bombogenesis.
Yeah.
Is that something real, or what do you...
No, it's, you know, I'm sort of a get-off-my-lawn when it comes to vocabulary guy, right? But that's especially bad because the word bomb for a cyclone already implies genesis. So you don't want to say bomb-o-genesis. It's like saying genesis-o-genesis. You know, it might be a great name for an Irish kid, but it's not really a good description of the weather.
Okay. Well, Tom in Minocqua has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I had read some study that in terms of, like, climate change for consumers, we don't really have that much power, because if we even went carbon neutral for a whole year, it would be offset by crude oil shipping containers in less than a week. Like, I don't understand what we're supposed to do with that aspect.
Yeah, I guess it's there's some truth to the fact that the individual consumer has very little control over, you know, how the global carbon dioxide fraction is going to change. It's determined by larger entities. But, you know, I think that the danger of succumbing to that sense of futility is that maybe you get less civically engaged, and maybe you demand less of your elected officials and so on. It can be, you know, sort of the downstream consequences of giving up. And so from my perspective, and it's just my own personal opinions, I try my best to make the best choice I can given the circumstances of the situation. So some easy ones are I try to turn the lights off in my house. I try to make sure if I'm going to travel somewhere, I think about at least a little bit, I have the means to do it, think about a way to do it that might be the least impactful. Not everyone can. I understand that and I respect it. But you try your best in your own circumstances to make some dent. And then the biggest thing I really think is hold to account elected officials who are supposed to be looking out for the benefit of all of us, the commonwealth. And when they don't, they need to hear about it. And sometimes with a vote against them. And I think that's the biggest thing we can all do.
I totally agree with John. I think that's a really good point you make. That you're right. It seems like it's so futile, but, you know, things add up. And it's going to take time. We didn't get to this situation overnight. And it's going to take more than overnight to deal with it.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you for calling. Jeff in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Love your show. Hey, like, you know, I'm in the sustainability field, got solar, drive an EV, but, you know, COP29, the recent COP29 meetings, other things, we have the technology, probably to slow climate change, but I don't have much faith in humanity. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I'm curious, are there any scientifically viable
I'm not saying you want to advocate these eco-engineered solutions to at least short-term reduce the climate change.
There are people who are very seriously thinking about what we call also geoengineering. I think there's another term. You used another one, and I like it, too. Geoengineering, trying to change something about the environment that would mitigate against the impacts of the ongoing warming. One that I know about is trying to put carbon soot in high up in the atmosphere that would absorb some of the energy from the sun away from the ground, or just trying to shade the earth a little bit by putting some particles in the atmosphere. Now, the problem I have with that is it goes back to one of the callers who just asked us earlier today about hurricanes. How are you going to mount that effort? How are you going to do it? How much will that cost compared to, making other decisions? And then the second part is, what control do you have over the distribution of those particles once you release them from your aircraft? You have no control at all. And so I don't think that the whole idea of unintended consequences comes to mind right away. You can't control what you're going to unleash in those scenarios. So I'm kind of skeptical as well. I don't think there's any particular solution there that presents itself.
Steve, anything to add there?
I think the other one that I have recently heard of is putting glass beads or mirrors up in the stratosphere just above the tropopause with the intent of reflecting solar energy out so we don't get as much solar energy across the planet. But again, all the comments that John just said apply to that as well. How do you do it? Why would you do it? And what are most importantly, what are the unintended consequences?
Mm. Yeah. And there are some others about pulling CO2 out of the air. There's some work done on that, pulling it out of the air and sticking it in the ground deep.
Yeah, carbon sequestration, they're calling that. And that, to me, if you're going to fund one of these types of things, that might be the one you do, because you can actually have at the end of the workday an actual amount of something you took out of the atmosphere, and you've cleaned up a problem is part of the problem, and that's with some control. You've controlled it. It's a controlled amount. So I think that's a good idea.
Jeff, again, thank you. Marty in Lake Geneva, your turn. Hi, Marty.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to preface my question with the following. Several years ago, there was a microburst that occurred, and a friend of mine who's a pilot said, well, maybe simple terms, but basically it's a river of air and it's constantly moving. It's about 150 miles an hour. When a hole forms in it, this air shoots down to the ground. So whether or not that's true or not, my question is, last year, we live on a lake, we have a shore station. We were the only ones, lucky us, to get hit by this, whatever this thing, I don't know if it was a tornado, whatever, or a microburst, but the shore station, it got hit, and it pulled it up. It pulled the frame upward, and that seems contrary to a microburst going down. Any thoughts on that?
I think one thing that came to my mind is that, when you have a microburst that comes down, when it hits the ground, it runs along the ground, and that could lead to grabbing something and pulling it upward, not just smashing it downward.
Yeah, that's a good point, Steve. You're exactly right. When the strong downdraft hits the ground, Da Vinci even had pictures of this. There's rotors on the skirt of that downdraft where the air is being forced to roll back. And so, and some of that air is going to have to be going upward. So maybe you got hit by the skirt of one of these things and it started to pull this stuff around in the direction exactly opposite to what you might have expected. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mary in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I have a two-part question. Prior to this year, where we had a full Indian summer, for me at least, and prior to that, it seems like early in October, it would just get cold and it wouldn't warm up. And I was wondering, do they keep track of this fall weather?
Yeah, you bet. This was a really interesting fall. We had May, June, and July that were wet, way beyond the average, and then it stopped raining.
Yeah.
August, September, and most of October. 27 days in October had less than 0.01 inches of precipitation in Madison. 22 of them had zero. So it was an exceptionally strange October compared to the last several years. And you're right, Mary. In the last, I think, four of the last 5 years, or at least three of the last 5 years, we've had snow, measurable snow in mid-October, and not this year. And so a very, very different year. So I can assure you I'm keeping track. I'm really interested. And I'll tell you one last thing. The Northern Hemisphere from September 1st to November 21st, it's when the last time I did a calculation was a few days ago, is the warmest ever Northern Hemisphere stretch from September 1 to November 21st in the last 78 years. And that's where I have all my data that I can make those claims from.
Wow.
So pretty unbelievable. So, and it conforms with what you just said.
Yeah. Mary, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Madison has a question. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. I got a kind of a technical question. I was wondering, for all the numbers we come up with for our carbon and oxygen levels and CO2 levels, all that stuff, how is that measured and where in the atmosphere is that measured? I used to live in the highest city in the United States. And I lived above 10,200 feet, and we would travel and be on a beach in Southern California 24 hours later, and there's a huge difference in the atmosphere just in breathable oxygen. And I tell people all the time, if you lay on your back and walk a half hour, 2 miles up, you start running out of oxygen. 3 miles up, you need a tank, you need oxygen to breathe, like Mount Everest. So where are these numbers measured in our atmosphere to actually come up with all these numbers?
Yeah, excellent question. The go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was just going to say there are sites that are dedicated to doing this and doing it over the long term. I'm pretty sure there's one in Boulder, Colorado, that actually makes those measurements.
Yeah, and the famous one for carbon dioxide fraction is on the top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. So it's at 10,000 feet. It's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. The air is pristine. And your point, Mike, is a good one. The density of the air is very variable with height. So if you climb to a high elevation, the number of oxygen molecules per unit volume is going to be smaller. That's why you gasp for breath, you know, at the top of the 10,000 footers in Colorado or the same near Mount Shasta. Now, the fraction of chemical constituents stays the same all the way up to, amazingly, 50 miles above the ground. So if you take a bag full of air at 35 miles above the ground, which is nowhere, nobody's making measurements there routinely. But if you do that and you bring it back to the lab and you count the fraction of carbon dioxide molecules to oxygen and nitrogen and all the rest, that fraction's the same all the way up to 50 miles. The total number in that bag is not the same. But the fraction is what matters, because that's what the radiation cares about, is how many molecules is it likely to excite on its path in or its path out. And so even though we make that measurement at 10,000 feet, The carbon dioxide fraction is an accurate testament because it doesn't change for 50 miles above the ground.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Mike. And let's take a call from Kristen in Eau Claire. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, good afternoon, Larry. I wanted to ask your guests, I know that they said that they were tired of trying to convince the skeptics that global climate change is, in fact, occurring. But in an area where, when science has been politicized, unfortunately, and when trust in our institutions is at a probably an all-time low, I would assume, how is there any work being done to try to talk to those people in our lives about how important this work is and how important it is for the future of our world, our children, for example, that we do address this?
So for skeptics who don't believe in climate change, are there ways to talk and convince them otherwise?
I think there are. I think that you can convince someone has as much reason to be skeptical about the force of gravity as they do about whether or not we're affecting the climate right now. And so a simple test, if they were allowed if you could get them to make the transition in their head, climb a tree and find the smallest branch and go as far out on it as you want without, and you know, are you going to believe that you're going to get injured? And if of course, gravity will injure you. The change in the climate is a real thing. And it's going to injure us if we don't start to do something about it. And I think that this maybe talking about climate as background rules to a game and, you know, using other analogies is maybe the way to try to convince people at least of what the problem is. But I don't know what the magic bullet is to get people who are dyed-in-the-wool skeptic about this to separate their skepticism from their ideology on other things. I don't know what the answer is. I wish I did.
I think what we do know, though, is name-calling and insulting are not likely to work.
Yep.
And that it's going to take a while with individuals who won't accept what the data is showing, is to convince them that this data is real.
Yeah. And I think in the background, Steve and I have talked about this offline a lot. You know, I think there's been an erosion in respect for expertise. Expertise takes decades to develop. And the fact that people who are, you know, not experts and haven't spent that time, haven't done their homework, are the ones who are calling the shots on things like this and getting more of the general population's attention is not only frustrating, but it's dangerous. And I like to put away the frustration pot because that's personal. But the danger pot is all of us are going to share in that danger. And so we're trying our best to be honest brokers of the information and the expertise about that information that we've both developed over 3+ decades to try and tell people what we think is going on. And I think all of our colleagues are involved in the same way with the same spirit.
And on that note, I want to thank you both again for being with us, and we will look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
Too. Thank you, Larry.
Yep. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, thank you.
Stay dry, Steve.
Yeah, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Great to have them with us today. A big thanks to them, and a big thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. I want to thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.